This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is hepatitis, and I'll introduce our guest shortly. But before I do that, I wanted to let those of you who are really interested in science about autism know of a new website that has just been initiated. It's called or entitled AutismScienceFoundation.org. There are plenty of good autism sites, but there are plenty of very poorly done sites as well. This particular site was opened up, interestingly enough, by Allison Singer. Allison was the former executive director of Autism Speaks. She had a falling out with them about their concerns about the need for more research into vaccines and autism, and she'd come to the conclusion that there is no link, which is generally accepted by individuals who are looking very closely at the causes of autism. The AutismScienceFoundation.org website is dedicated to bringing some of the very best evidence-based information on autism. It's a not-for-profit organization, and you can get there by going to www.AutismScienceFoundation.org, and we'll make an effort to put that up on our website. My guests today are Brian McMahon. Brian is a specialist in hepatitis. He's really probably one of the better recognized individuals in our country about hepatitis, and is in particular has been a author on the practice guidelines for the management of hepatitis B, which is used by physicians throughout the country and internationally on the management of hepatitis B. He's had a dramatic role in the marked decline in hepatitis B problems within the native population in his lifetime up here, primarily through the use of vaccines, but we'll have him tell us about that. And has also recently been awarded the Distinguished Scientist Award in 2009 by the Hepatitis B Foundation. In addition, Ginger Provo is in the studio with us as well. She's a nurse epidemiologist with the state of Alaska, the Department of Public Health, and she serves as the Adult Viral Hepatitis Prevention Coordinator for the state. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much, Thad.
Hepatitis is maybe a little bit bigger subject than people might think. And when I say let's define hepatitis, you could write a book almost on causes of hepatitis. So, Brian, let me ask you, when we talk about hepatitis today, what are we going to be talking about in particular?
Well, hepatitis in general just means inflammation of the liver. It means that the liver is swollen and filled with pus cells, and the cells are dying and regenerating at the same time. And there's many causes of hepatitis. Viruses are one of the most common causes, but alcoholic hepatitis is also a very common cause. Medications such as Tylenol, hepatitis. There's also other organisms, bacteria that can cause hepatitis, or even parasites like toxoplasmosis, which is found in cats. And also there's autoimmune hepatitis, which can be caused by the immune system going haywire and attacking the liver and causing inflammation in the liver that way.
Okay. So we're going to be trying to stick with hepatitis A, B, and C?
Right. The hepatitis A, B, and C. Hepatitis D is not really found very often in Alaska, and it occurs with hepatitis B. And so when you're vaccinated against hepatitis B, you're protected against hepatitis D. And hepatitis E is a virus which you have to worry about if you either work in a pig farm or you travel to a country where there's a lot of hepatitis E, which is like Mexico or Africa or India. I don't think we have much to say about hepatitis E at this time, except there is a vaccine, but it's not available.
Ginger, one of the reasons we're doing this program this month is that there is a national or World Hepatitis Day month, I guess it is, and a National Hepatitis Day. I may be getting that wrong. And why is that being done?
Well, first of all, it's the 14th annual National Hepatitis Month, and it's the second annual World Hepatitis Day. And it was World Hepatitis Day was started by the World Hepatitis Alliance in 2007 by a coalition of 200 hepatitis patient advocate groups. And it's to bring awareness to the fact that 1 in 12 people worldwide are living with either chronic hepatitis B or C.
Okay. So when we talk about A, B, and C, we're talking about three viral illnesses. So let's flesh out these viruses because although they're viruses, they're different. They're different maybe in transmission. They're differences in outcome, differences in acute illness, different maybe in the fact that one of those may cause cancer. I'm not so sure I can answer all those questions. But let's talk about what the difference is. Who wants to handle that?
I'm going to do it. Okay. So the three hepatitis that we're going to concentrate on, which are seen here in Alaska, are hepatitis A, B, and C. And hepatitis A is a virus that's transmitted by contaminated feces, and the virus can get into the water supply, can get into food, and it can be transmitted by person to person by just touching people and transmitting the virus that way, and then they ingesting the virus accidentally and getting hepatitis A. And fortunately, we used to have horrible epidemics in Alaska that involved thousands of people about every 7 or 8 years. But there was a vaccine that was developed for hepatitis A that's now required for school entry and is given to all children under 20 and people who are traveling to places where there still is hepatitis A, such as Mexico, are recommended to get the vaccine. And because of that, these epidemics have stopped, and now we've gone from the highest rate of hepatitis A in the world to the lowest rate the highest rate in the United States, to the lowest rate in the U.S.
Okay.
And hepatitis B is a bloodborne virus, which is transmitted by open cuts and scratches. It's a very hardy virus. It survives on environmental surfaces. So it can be transmitted by someone contaminating an environmental surface with a open cut or scratch and then someone else coming along with an open cut or scratch and getting in contact with that surface and then getting infected. It's also transmitted by it used to be transmitted by blood transfusion, but fortunately the blood supply has been screened since before 1980 for hepatitis B. And blood supply is now safe, but also transmitted by injecting drugs, illicit use of needles, and is very easily to be transmitted sexually also. And it can cause two forms of illnesses. One is an acute form where a patient gets quite ill, turns yellow, nausea, vomiting, lasts for a few weeks to several weeks, and usually the patients recover, or a chronic infection, which occurs in about 30% of children under 5 and about 90% of children who are infected at birth. And I might have added that another way to get hepatitis B is from an infected mother to the child at the time of birth when there's mixing of mother and infant's blood. Those patients usually don't get sick but become chronically infected and have about a 25% lifetime risk of getting liver cancer or cirrhosis of the liver. Hepatitis C is the hardest of the viruses to transmit. It's also a bloodborne virus, and it's transmitted almost exclusively by injecting drug use, which is the number one reason for transmission in the U.S. And prior to 1992, by contaminated blood before a test was developed to screen the blood supply, which is now safe. Less than 10% of the cases are transmitted in other ways. It can be transmitted sexually, but it's very difficult to transmit. It also could theoretically be transmitted by body piercing, by tattooing, by snorting cocaine and sharing a straw, or other ways. But these all represent less than 10% of the cases of hepatitis C. And hepatitis C, very few patients get acute hepatitis and get sick. They usually recover also. That represents about 15 to 25%. And about 75 to 85% of patients become chronically infected, and usually they don't know they've gotten this infection. And just like hepatitis B, it's a silent infection. And when the patient develops complications such as cirrhosis of the liver or liver cancer, that's when they first become aware of it, unless they've been screened.
Let me go ahead and let our listeners know that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our topic is hepatitis, and here's some ways to get in touch with us if you've got questions about what you hear, if you'd like to talk about specific instances of hepatitis that you're aware of or some of your experiences. In Anchorage, you can dial 550-8433, 550-8433, between now and just before 3 o'clock Anchorage time, and you can get an answer to your questions, or you can make some comments. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email directly to me at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And remember, this program is live between 2 and 3 Anchorage time. It repeats between 8 and 9, and there's no specific answers being given at that later time when it's rebroadcast. Also, please remember, if you have friends or relatives or someone you'd like to hear the program, you can go to kska.org/line1 and look at the archives of previous programs and listen to this program at any time. So there's distinct differences between what sound like fairly common illnesses or similar illnesses with A, B, and C, with what I'm hearing is A being transmitted orally, the other two have some bloodborne exposures, the B and C have some potentially dastardly long-term side effects. Hepatitis A is usually fairly self-limited. A and B have vaccines, C don't.
Right? That's correct. That's correct.
All right. So let's talk just briefly about hepatitis A. We're, like many vaccine illnesses that we have vaccines for, we're seeing less and less of that over time. It's not as big an issue as it used to be, and that's part of what the state's doing is keeping surveillance on these
things? Yes, we do have a surveillance database, and we accept reports of hepatitis A, B, and C. We do have the database for acute A and B, and I'd like to let practitioners know that if you think you have an acute case of hepatitis A or B that you're working up, to let Section of Epidemiology know about that. We are able to put some control measures in there, including immune globulin or vaccine, if we are notified within the window period for that treatment. And we do accept all reports of hepatitis C, acute and chronic, and we are also building our database for chronic hepatitis B so that we know what our burden of disease is in our population.
Do you get most of your input from physician on these three illnesses from physician reporting, or are you also monitoring testing and test results that are being done?
Most of our reports come from laboratories. Mm-hmm. We do have some clinicians, practitioners call in. Most of the reporting does come from laboratories in and out of state and through all the hospitals as well.
Okay. Hepatitis A, when I first started 30 years ago, we would see it in kids. Often we'd miss it in kids because it looked like, in young kids, just a vomiting illness. They didn't get as much jaundice. We picked up things when the adults got it. And then the kids were getting it sometimes within daycare centers. I haven't seen a case, haven't recognized a case in a long time. Where do people get hepatitis A now? Who is the group at risk now?
Well, basically, almost everybody who's under the age of 20 or 25 has been vaccinated, and they're immune. And we are doing at ANMC the longest studies in children to see how long protection lasts. And basically, I can tell you that 100% of kids who are vaccinated at a young age still have protective antibody 15 years out. So I think this looks like this vaccine protection is going to last for a heck of a long time. We see very few cases. Most of the cases are occurring in adults who escaped one of the past epidemics, and maybe they went out and traveled to Mexico or someplace and ate the raw shrimp or drank the ice cubes in their drink and got hepatitis A that way. And so there are, and Ginger can correct me on this, on the last time I looked at it, it's about 1% or less per 100,000 persons in the state of acute hepatitis A that we see now.
Yeah, that's true. We literally just get a handful a year of those reports. And like you said, they're mostly, or if not all, travelers outside the country.
In my mind, hepatitis A vaccine is really one of the really great, great vaccines. Low reaction rates, nothing really to talk about there. Often one dose is a pretty effective vaccine, is my understanding, although two is recommended. That true?
That's true, because, in fact, we did a study where we showed that within 2 weeks after one dose of hepatitis A vaccine, more than 90% of people had protective antibodies. And actually, a study was done in Kazakhstan recently, published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, where they took patients who were household contacts of people who got who had hepatitis A, and they randomized them to the old immune globulin, which hurts like heck if you've ever had. I've had several of those shots in my life, and they're very uncomfortable. Or one dose of the vaccine, and there wasn't any difference. The vaccine was almost – it was just as quick as the immune globulin, I should say. And then the second dose of the vaccine is pretty much to give you a high titer that, so that you'll have lasting immunity for a long period of time. So it's an excellent vaccine. There's virtually 100% of people who are immune competent, have a good immune system, will respond to this vaccine.
Okay. All right. So let's move on from hepatitis A. That's an issue. If we keep our defenses up, we should be doing okay. And unfortunately, that's a big if, which we may come back to. A very controllable illness, not nearly as capricious and dangerous as hepatitis B and C anyway. So let's remind me once again, what's the major differences between B and C, particularly in illnesses and long-term outcome and knowing whether you're sick or not with this particular these viruses?
Well, hepatitis B, it's a DNA virus, and hepatitis C is an RNA virus, and they're very different. But the illnesses are similar. More patients with hepatitis B, as they get older, will get sick and recover. But in young patients, more of them are more apt to become chronically infected. With hepatitis C, there doesn't seem to be an age difference. About a quarter of the patients at best will recover, and about three-quarters of them won't recover. Both of them can cause liver cancer. The rate with hepatitis B is higher than hepatitis C. And one of the reasons is that the virus can integrate itself into the DNA of the host cell. It has retrovirus properties like HIV, and because of that, it has a much higher risk of developing cancer. Hepatitis C, in order to get cancer with that, you have to get cirrhosis. You don't with hepatitis B, for example. So hepatitis C, the people, is usually a very slowly progressive disease, progresses over 20 years, maybe 20% of people will get cirrhosis. And then once they get cirrhosis, they're at risk for liver cancer and risk for liver failure. But before that, they're really not at any risk. Both of these chronic infections are primarily asymptomatic. There's a little bit more fatigue associated with hepatitis C, kind of chronic fatigue, but not with hepatitis B. So people oftentimes don't know they have either one of these diseases.
How might they come to realize they have it most commonly?
Most commonly when they get cancer and they get sick or when their liver fails and they develop they start swelling up and turn yellow and get really sick.
So they're not picked up with a screening test as often as we'd like, maybe, with liver function studies? They really become ill, having been infected for a long time.
Yeah, every once in a while we get someone referred from one of the health fairs, because at the health fairs, if you pay $70 or whatever it is, you can get your blood drawn for a variety of tests, cholesterol and all kinds of. And usually liver function, ALT, a liver function enzyme, is in there. And if it's elevated, patients will get referred to their provider, and the providers oftentimes will think about, well, I better screen for hepatitis B and C, and they'll sometimes find these patients. But most of them, if they're going to get tested, they usually become aware of the fact that they're at risk. So we could at some point in the show talk about who are the people that ought to go out and ask to get tested.
Okay. Yeah, I want to do that. Before we do, I have to take a short break. I want to let everybody know you're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Hi, this is Dr. Thad Woodard, and you're listening to Line One. Today we're talking about hepatitis, and we've just heard a little brief description of the differences between hepatitis A, B, and C, and we're going to be focusing primarily on B and C for the rest of the program. If you've got any questions or comments about any of the hepatitis, the virally acquired hepatitis A, B, and C, you can call us at 550-8433 between now and about 3 o'clock or just before, and we'll try to answer your questions or respond to your comments. Our outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And also, you can email me directly during the program at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. I know it's important that we go to this issue about risk factors so that people who are at risk might be found a little bit earlier and before they get severely ill. But we've also just been a little bit better educated about viruses from the concerns about the new H1N1 virus. And maybe it's a good time to just rehash how viruses cause illnesses. We heard a little bit, people who are reading, listening to the news. You've mentioned RNA and DNA viruses. Just flesh that out a little bit more, how viruses give us problems.
Well, we probably are infected with a lot of viruses which don't bother us at all. It's pretty amazing. Sometimes we'll get infected with a virus like EBV virus, which causes mono, and that virus will persist and rarely cause problems later in life. So there viruses are around, but viruses have to enter the cell in order to damage the cell, whereas bacteria can damage the cell from outside the cell. So viruses enter the cell, and then they basically are like terrorists. They take over the cell. They take over the controls of the cell, and then they get the cell to manufacture more of the viruses. And as they do that, the immune system begins to recognize the virus, and then it mobilizes all of its immune components, such as white cells and chemicals called cytokines, and it goes in and kills the virus. But while doing that, it has to destroy the cell. So the viruses sometimes can damage cells and destroy them, but more often they want the cell to persist so they can manufacture more of themselves and go out in the body and infect more cells. So it's the immune system which is doing the damage, and sometimes our immune systems are strong enough to completely kick a virus out. Like if we get the flu and recover, we've kicked out that particular strain of the flu virus. But at other times, the viruses are pretty tricky, like HIV, for example. Hepatitis C and B both can do that too. Although they're not at all related to HIV, they can trick the body so the immune system will attack the virus and damage the cells, but it won't be able to kill off all the virus.
And you made another comment. Some of these DNA not only hijack our own genome and get it to do work like, hey, make some more of viral particles for me. I don't want to do that. But they also can cause cancer in certain ways. You want to just – I don't want to get too deep, but I think it's important to hear this every once in a while. Maybe we'll have more.
Well, there are a number of viruses that cause cancer. Hepatitis B is a direct cause of cancer. Hepatitis C is an indirect cause of cancer because it causes cirrhosis. And anything that causes cirrhosis, such as alcoholic cirrhosis or other forms of cirrhosis, are at risk for developing liver cancer. So it's probably in those cases the cirrhosis that do it. But in hepatitis B, it's the virus. And another example of that is human papillomavirus, which causes cervical cancer. Epstein-Barr virus is another example. The mononucleosis virus, which can cause a form of lymphoma, it can also cause nasopharyngeal cancer. And another example of that would be, let's see, I'm trying to think of another example. I can't think of one right now, but I probably will in a minute.
Okay.
So.
And hepatitis B does that by actually affecting the genome and maybe decreasing some protective genes or increasing genes that give us more risk for cancer?
Well, what it does is it actually integrates itself into the genome. So in other words, you have your own DNA, and all of a sudden a piece of hepatitis B is inserted into your DNA. Mm-hmm. And this goes on during the lifetime of a person who's chronically infected. And the theory is we don't know exactly how it works, but because the integration is random throughout the whole person's genome, there's probably an instance where if the integration occurs and knocks out a protective gene which protects cells from stops cells from growing, and that allows the liver cells to grow uncontrolled and become cancerous, is one way that we think that it might occur.
Okay. All right. Let me remind our listeners, if you've got questions or comments about hepatitis A, B, or C, call 550-8433 between now and 3 o'clock, and we'll see if we can answer your questions. Or you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at ksk.org. Ginger, what are the services that the state is supplying and providing for us to help us control hepatitis?
Well, we do have our surveillance database, and we have a web page, www.epi.alaska.gov /ID/hepatitis, which gives all of the Alaska information, off-site websites. It also has a resource guide for clients and practitioners, including links to patient assist programs for clients undergoing treatment that need help paying for treatment and medications. We have free laboratory services. If you go to our public health centers, they will draw and handle the specimen for a fee, and our laboratory is for free. And we do some education to community groups, specifically the Hepatitis Prevention Planning Group and some substance abuse directors. Another thing that we have going on right now is a vaccination initiative. You know, we do vaccinate all of our children through age 18 with hepatitis A and B, and since 2001, it has been a requirement for a school admission. And so all of our children probably through their late 20s are vaccinated, pretty well vaccinated. But there's that group that's a bit older than that, the hard-to-reach group, that we are trying to reach with our vaccination initiative. It's the 317 Hepatitis B initiative for high-risk adults. And you can get that vaccine through all of our public health centers statewide. Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center is offering it to its clients and some of the other community health centers around the state. We're also offering a hepatitis A and B clinic to clients that get services through 4A's, the Alaskan AIDS Association of Alaska, for their syringe exchange users and their HIV clients. And, just wanted to get that word out to all clients and practitioners statewide that we are offering those services through the state.
So hepatitis B is a bloodborne transmission. It is preventable by a vaccine, and it is particularly prevalent in high-risk groups. So what we'd like to do if we're trying to stop this transmission is identify those high-risk individuals and get them vaccinated. So what are the specific high-risk groups, and what should people in those groups be doing?
Well, some of the high-risk groups, well, since it is a sexually transmitted disease, we want to have practitioners screen people that come in for sexually transmitted infections, people that are not in long-term mutually monogamous relationships, people that are using IV drugs, that have HIV infection, people that work in healthcare or in public safety that might be exposed to blood and body fluids, people that are born or whose parents were born in areas of the world where hepatitis B is common, and Dr. McMahon talked about those areas, or if you are a household contact of those people, if you're planning to travel to any of those places, if you are on long-term dialysis or work or live in a facility for developmentally disabled people, you're all at higher risk for contracting hepatitis B, and our vaccination initiative is open to all of these groups.
You know, I'm constantly going back and forth between things, and before we came on the program, we mentioned that people from certain parts of the world are at higher risk of getting this, and I don't know if you mentioned that or not, Ginger, if I missed it, but it seems to me to be important to mention that people that were born in the Caribbean, if we didn't say that, and you said Southeast Asia, because we're seeing a lot of those patients moving into Alaska at this particular time. Did you mention that those are people, and is it fair and reasonable that those people be screened in particular?
Yeah, I'll answer that question, Thad. I went on the internet to see what the population of Alaska that was born outside of Alaska was, and in the state of our over 600,000 patients, about 6% were our foreign-born people, and in Anchorage, that's a little over 8%. And if persons were born in parts of the world where there's a high rate of hepatitis B, and I might mention that of the 6 billion people in the world, 2 billion of those, that's one third of the world's population, have encountered hepatitis B virus. About 400,000 of those persons are chronically infected, and about 1 million people a year worldwide die of hepatitis B, and that puts hepatitis B in the WHO's list of infectious disease killers right between measles and HIV. So it's higher than measles, lower than HIV, but it's a pretty big problem. And the areas of the world where if you were born in this area, you have friends who were born in this area, you'd want to get tested for hepatitis B, include all of Asia, all of Africa, Eastern Europe, and Russia, the Middle East, of course, as part of Asia, and South America in the Amazon Delta part of South America, and also in the Caribbean, and in the South Pacific Islands. All of the South Pacific Islands are endemic for hepatitis B. So in any of those, if you're born in any of those areas, which is much of the world, you should go to your provider or go to one of the state clinics where screening is offered and get screened, and they will tell you whether or not you are infected or whether or not you need the vaccine.
And some of those individuals may have had the illness in the past, and we can tell that, and they've eradicated it and are not at any particular risk, but we're looking for those individuals who have chronic infection, and testing can identify that even if you don't feel sick.
Right. I mean, it's just like the spot that we just had before when we took our break on stroke. Mm-hmm. You can have high blood pressure all of your life and be totally asymptomatic. And the right. first thing that happens to you is you suddenly wake up in the morning and you've lost the use of half of your body. And it's the same with hepatitis B. You can suddenly get sick over a few days and turn yellow and have liver cancer. So it is very important. And the reason for that with hepatitis B especially is we've got some really – in the last 10 years, the drug companies have developed some great drugs for treating hepatitis B. Not everybody needs to be treated. About half of the people population with this infection their immune system will control the infection. So the infection can't progress, can't damage them, and they'll be at very low risk of getting cancer or cirrhosis. But about anywhere from 30 to 40% of people – they can't control the infection, and they'll start damaging their liver. And those people can really benefit by antiviral therapy, which has now been shown in randomized controlled trials to decrease the risk of developing cancer or liver failure from cirrhosis if you're chronically infected. So you need to go to your doctor, get screened, and then evaluated by someone who treats hepatitis B. And in our community, it's primarily gastroenterologists and infectious disease doctors, but some primary care doctors also are very good at treating it, and then get them to evaluate you and find out if you need treatment or not.
And Ginger, what I'm hearing you say is the state is providing, particularly for hepatitis B, high-risk candidate screening and immunization.
That's right.
If they're candidates for it.
That's right. Through our public health centers, statewide, you can be screened, and you can also be vaccinated. And some of the local community health centers and, as I said, the 4-ACE clinic is also offering those clinics.
If you have questions or comments about what you hear today, 550-8433 is our local number. Outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. I do want to let a person know who sent me an email wanting to know about treatment of hepatitis C, and we will get to that question as we talk about treatment. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit more about hepatitis C. How does it relate to hepatitis B and the frequency and prevalence of infections, and what do we have to offer those individuals for prevention and so forth?
Well, hepatitis C has been reportable since 1996, and for about the last 10 years, we have received 800 to about 1,000 reports a year of hepatitis C in Alaska. I do want to state that not all of these people have hepatitis C. About 25% of people that are infected can clear their virus. Some of these people may have passed on, may have moved. There might be some duplicates, but the trend is that, you know, we're getting quite a few cases. There is not a serologic marker for acute infections, so these are cases that are not new cases every year, but may have been infected over the last 20 years or so, as Dr. McMahon explained, and now people are getting sick and getting screened, and we're finding out about them.
Mm-hmm. And prevention?
Prevention is, well, since the main transmission is IV drug use, syringe exchange, there are two syringe exchange programs in Alaska. One is in Fairbanks and one is in Anchorage. Just the awareness of the transmission of the disease. Tattooing is another way of transmitting in DOC, you know, at-home tattooing. Anything that's outside a licensed tattoo parlor is at high risk. Piercings, needle sticks in healthcare settings, sharing personal items, some perinatal transmission. As Dr. McMahon said, all of those are much lower risk. A little bit of risk with sexual transmission, which increases if you're co-infected with HIV or if there is another sexually transmitted infection going on at the same time, it's higher risk. But most of that is through IVD use, so syringe exchange is our main way of prevention.
Unlike hepatitis B, it sounds like, Brian, where we have the vaccine so we can go out and find people who have not been infected and stop that transmission potential, vitamin C. Hepatitis C does not have a vaccine at this time that I'm aware of.
No, there is no vaccine. The problem with this virus is it's like HIV. In the critical part of the virus for which vaccines are usually made, which is the covering of the virus or the surface of the virus, there's areas that mutate very rapidly and very quickly, so that it's very difficult to find proteins that can be used to make a vaccine. And that, so far, we've been unsuccessful in doing that. So the best way for prevention is just what Ginger had said, trying to prevent transmission. But I might want to mention one thing, is that when we talk about injecting drug users, we're talking about anyone who's ever injected a drug. And I know many professional people who have, when they're back in college, when they're having they're pretty straight people, and they once in a while did something unusual. They might have just shot up one time at a party and gotten hepatitis B or hepatitis C. I'm sorry, hepatitis C. So the question that we ask people is not, are you an injecting drug user, but have you ever in your life, even once, injected a drug? And if you have, then you should be tested for hepatitis C.
I know, and maybe I should be aware of this, being a pediatrician, that all pregnant women are tested for hepatitis B. Are they routinely tested for hepatitis C, and why not?
No, and in fact, I'm on an Institute of Medicine committee that's supposed to make some recommendations for the U.S. this year about hepatitis B and C, and we actually looked at this in great detail, and it turns out that it's not cost-effective to do that. What is cost-effective is to, in a questionnaire, to ask the risk factor to a pregnant woman, and then if they have those risk factors, go ahead and screen them for hepatitis C.
I got you. You were about to say something?
Oh, I just wanted to also add that a lot of people call and ask me about transmitting hepatitis C through food, mm-hmm. food handling, yep. casual contact, and just to state that no, hepatitis C is not transmitted through food handling, food workers, restaurant workers, kissing, hugging, shaking hands, you know, casual contact.
And the same for hepatitis B. It's the same thing. It's not transmitted by sharing food and hugging people or things like that.
How about, so we know, or I know, that the vertical transmission from mother to baby for hepatitis B occurs primarily during the birth process.
Right.
So I got the same question about C, And the other question is, what about breast milk for B and C as being transmission?
Yeah, for as far as the C goes, we really don't know what the risk or what actually occurs. We think it occurs at the time of birth, but we do know with hepatitis B that there are a small proportion, maybe up to 5% of infants who are infected in utero, probably from small breaks and bleeding in the placenta that occurs, and then they get infected before they're delivered. And in those patients, the vaccine, right now what we do is we give vaccine, and if we know the mother's positive, we also give hepatitis B immune globulin to the baby, and we can prevent 95% to 97% of infections from occurring. And that rate could be as high as 100% if they weren't vaccinated right at birth. But there is a failure rate, and that may be due to inner utero. And then with hepatitis C, and you only see about 5% of infants who get infected unless their mother has HIV, then it's up to about 20%. So those 5% of infections, they could take place in utero or they could take place right at the time of birth. We just don't know which is actually the predominant method.
And breast milk?
Breast milk is not infectious for either hepatitis B or hepatitis C, and we do not discourage breastfeeding. For hepatitis B, of course, that infant's going to be vaccinated, so there's no worry there. And for hepatitis C, it's very difficult to transmit it unless it's direct blood contact and blood-to-blood contact. So the risk is extremely low. So we don't discourage breastfeeding in either one of those circumstances.
All right, so we have this email that says, what are the latest treatments regarding hepatitis C, and how effective are they at eliminating the virus, and how about promising trials? So I guess I'd like to use that question as a jump-off into treatment, and that looks like that's going to be your answer here, Dr. McMahon.
Okay, well, the good news is that there's two good news. One is there is treatment for hepatitis C. The second good news that's just been revealed is hepatitis C can actually be cured by treatment, although you could get it again if you went back to, for example, using injecting drugs because you can get a different strain. So the treatment, though, the not-so-good news, I didn't say bad news, but not-so-good news is that the treatment is pretty darn rough. Unlike hepatitis B, where hepatitis B treatment suppresses the virus but doesn't really kill it but can suppress it for indefinitely, and most of the treatments for hepatitis B, with the exception of one called interferon, which is the primary treatment for hepatitis C, have very few, if any, side effects. So people with hepatitis B that are treated usually don't get sick from the treatment. Hepatitis C, everybody pretty much gets sick from the treatment with hepatitis C. The treatment that's used for hepatitis C is interferon or a form of interferon. Usually it's a long-acting or pegylated form, plus an oral drug called ribavirin. And interferon is a naturally occurring, I could almost say it's a health food protein, which is made by human white cells. And some smart Jurassic Park scientists cloned the gene for interferon, and it's made, this gene is made, it's human interferon. So it's a pure natural human product. And interferon is the chemical that your white cells make when you get sick with a virus. So if you get the influenza flu, the H1N1 swine flu, for example, you would feel that you're having a fever, a headache, a body aches, tiredness, and you'd be saying, oh, that darn flu virus is doing this to me. Well, it's not the flu virus. It's your white cells producing tons of interferon to kill that virus. So when you get a shot of long-acting interferon, about an hour later, you have the flu, and you feel just like that. And at end of a week, it starts to wear off, and then you get another shot. And this goes on for between 24 and 48 weeks. And the other side effects of the drug are that it causes it can affect your bone marrow, not permanently, but you have to watch people's white cells and red cells. It causes depression in up to 30% of patients. Occasionally causes hair loss, although that's reversible and grows back. And there are another number of other side effects. And there are three primary genotypes that are found in the United States of hepatitis C: genotype 1, 2, and 3. If you have genotype 1, it takes 48 weeks of interferon and ribavirin to complete a course of treatment, and about 40 to 50% of people will be cured at 48 weeks, but the others will fail the treatment and not be cured. Now, we're getting really pretty darn good at predicting at the first or the third month who's gonna respond, so we can stop the treatment early in many of the patients. But it's very frustrating to give people a treatment that's that's this difficult to take and then have half of them fail. With genotypes 2 and 3, which are in the minority of infections in the United States, they represent about 20 to, at the most, 25%. Those patients, we only have to treat for 24 weeks, and the cure rate is somewhere between 70 and 80%. So it's a much, much brighter situation. I can later talk about new drugs coming online, too.
Before we do that, while we're on the subject, genotypes mean that we're talking about hepatitis C, but like people who might understand influenza, these viruses are same virus, but they're a little bit different genetically.
Right.
And therefore, they cause a little bit different kinds of illnesses, just like the swine flu that we think did so much damage in 1919 is an influenza, but for some reason it was much, much more virulent for what's going on in its genome. And that's kind of the analogy with these hepatitis C different strains. Is that fair to say?
Right, that's fair to say. And it's there's a kind of an interesting difference between hepatitis B and C. And hepatitis B, the genotypes all respond to treatment the same way. Unfortunately, the vaccine protects you against all eight of the different genotypes that are found around the world. But these genotypes have very different effects on the risk of cancer. For example, in Alaska Natives, we have five different genotypes. So five different periods of time the virus was introduced. Some of them are centuries and centuries old. Others are more modern. One of these genotypes, genotype F, is strongly associated with liver cancer in children as young as 8 years of age. And so we have a very unusual situation with children getting liver cancer, but now we don't have any children that are chronically infected with hepatitis B thanks to the vaccine. So liver cancer has disappeared in children in Alaska, which is quite a remarkable thing. And other genotypes, genotype C, which comes from China, and people who have immigrated to the United States from Korea, China, and Vietnam, places like that, they're likely to have hepatitis C or genotype C of hepatitis B. And that's a nasty genotype which has a very high risk of cancer and cirrhosis. And so that's why it's important these people be checked for that genotype. Now, in hepatitis C, the genotypes which are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, 7 and 8, et cetera, those genotypes have more to do with how they respond to the treatment. So genotype 1 isn't any worse than 2 or 3 or 4, but genotype 1 is more resistant than genotypes 2 and 3 to treatment. So it's the opposite of what you see with hepatitis B, where they're all sensitive to treatment, but some of them are more virulent than others.
Okay. And you were going to mention something about some ongoing or promising trials, new treatments on the horizon perhaps.
Yeah, this is really we were pretty discouraged in this field about 5 years ago because they didn't seem to be making much progress in developing antivirals. But in the last couple of years, there's been some huge breakthroughs. And now there are about 20 drugs that are in the process of being developed. Two of these drugs are in the what we call the phase 3 trials, the last of the trials before licensure, and we think that one or both of these drugs might be licensed in about 2011. And one of the drugs that's the furthest along is called telepivir. It's a protease inhibitor, kind of like the protease inhibitors that target HIV, which don't, of course, work against any other virus but HIV. And this particular protease inhibitor attacks the part of the virus that cuts the virus's protein so that they're useful and they can cover the virus and protect it. And it blocks that mechanism. The problem is that if you use these drugs alone, you develop resistance within a week or two to them. The virus becomes resistant to them. But if they're added on to the interferon ribavirin, which we have right now, it looks like from the preliminary studies that it will shorten the course of treatment for this genotype 1, the more resistant virus, and it'll increase the cure rate. So the treatment would shorten to about 24 weeks instead of 48 weeks, and the cure rate would go up to about 70% from 40 to 50 to 70%, which is really good news. And then other drugs as they come along, I think, will even do better. And we're hoping that eventually we'll get rid of the interferon, which is the hardest, the one that causes the most side effects. The problem is that when you add this third drug, telepivir, there's going to be more side effects. Of course, they'll last for a lot shorter. And they include gastrointestinal side effects, and some patients develop a very troubling rash, which goes away when you stop the drug. But but you have to stop the drug because the rash is very, very itchy and people can't stand it any longer. So they offer a lot. There's a lot of hope in the future, but again, we're probably going to have to go through some pain before we reach the perfect drugs for hepatitis C.
And I guess I would be remiss, or I would like to be quick to point out that, like in most situations, the prevention is far, far, far better than the treatment, although we're making advances. Many of us were worried would never come against viruses. Science has moved on to where we can. Yeah. But prevention is really still the key. And it needs to be said that that vaccines are a cornerstone of prevention of many of these illnesses. Another question. This is someone who's written in and said, I had hepatitis 35 years ago while working near the Thai-Burma border, probably from eating in the market stalls. It was a tenacious case. I had jaundice for 3 months. What type of hepatitis was popular back then before the alpha strains? I'm not sure what that means. You might know. Did we have anything in the form of inoculations available then? Was there any prevention? I think he's asking. I've been careful to point out this risk in my health records. I've never suffered a recurrence. But at my advanced age, I wonder if there are measures I should or could take to suppress further problems and extend life expectancy.
Well, the likelihood is that this person had hepatitis A, which he got it right on the nose, or he or she got it basically by eating food that had been contaminated. But it's possible it could have been hepatitis B because there were a lot of people in Vietnam that got hepatitis B also. And so it might be worthwhile just to go to your provider or down to one of the state screening and testing places and tell that story and get tested for both hepatitis A and hepatitis B. If it was hepatitis A, you're immune for life. You'll never get it again. And if it was hepatitis B, you're probably immune. There's a greater than 90% chance you're immune for life, but there's also a possibility you might be chronically infected. There was the only injection that was available during the Vietnam War was gamma globulin, and I think the troops got gamma globulin. The problem with the gamma globulin is you had to give it about every 2 months because it wore off, and so likely if you got a shot that really hurt like heck and looked like putty coming out of the syringe.
And with a large volume.
Oh, it hurts so bad, let me tell you. I had several of those. And then you probably got that gamma globulin, but it's basically pooled globulin, human protein, from other people who recovered from hepatitis A, and it wears off in just a short period of time, in a couple of months. So you have to keep getting it, which is difficult to do when you're out in the combat and in that kind of a situation.
Ginger, here's a question. As a person writes in and says, I was vaccinated in 1993 for hepatitis A, 2-dose vaccine. I'm an adult. Well, I need a booster. If so, when? I do a moderate amount of international travel.
So you either were in one of our trials up here, or you got it right when it came out, because that's about the timing. Or you got it in Europe, because it was actually licensed in Europe about 2 or 3 years before it was in the United States. As far as we can tell, the vaccine, as I mentioned, in children, it's the same with adults, lasts for at least 15 years. We've projected some computer models based on the data that we have, and there have also been some computer models that have been projected in adults in Europe, and it looks like the vaccine protects for probably about 30 years at least, and maybe more. So I would say you're in good shape, and you don't need a booster dose right now, but we're continuing to study this issue, and we think we'll be able to tell people if they need a booster dose, if ever. We're not sure whether anybody will ever need a booster dose.
There has recently been in the New England Journal of Medicine some perspective articles, review of the study of an increasing concern among public health individuals, healthcare providers in this country, that the anti-vaccine lobby is increasing in its power. And I don't myself worry about that group, because I think when you try to teach those people what's going on, it's like religion. But what that does is it leads to a huge number of people who are confused. And I've heard all kinds of arguments against vaccines, and you're one of the people I can look at in the eye and say, you know, you've been there, done that, seen the response, you're a physician, you understand what's going on. Give me your perspective on vaccinology and the appropriateness of it and where you'd place it in our public health armamentarium.
Well, first I might say, Thad, that I put myself in every one of our vaccine trials, and my kids and my wife, who got hepatitis B vaccine during her second trimester because we were out doing vaccine studies in the bush. And I felt then the vaccines were very safe, and I know for sure now that they are very safe. There was this worry about autism and multiple sclerosis in people who came who received hepatitis B vaccine, and for a while this really kind of hindered vaccination. But what happened was they did some very large studies and showed that there was no difference in the incidence of those complications in persons who'd received vaccine versus the general population. So vaccines are extremely safe. These vaccines are extremely safe as well as other vaccines. It's the best way to prevent illness. And I think people should be reassured that they're safe. And my kids and I've gotten all those vaccines, and we're not worried.
Yeah, my kids are all vaccinated, despite the fact that they don't like when I come home and remind them they need another one. But I think many people have felt that vaccines are probably one of the major public health advances in the history of civilization. I mean, maybe indoor toilets and vaccinations, and yet there's always going to be somebody who has some concerns.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that the life expectancy at the turn of the century was around 40 years of age, and most people died of in infancy or childhood from those kinds of diseases, measles and other preventable diseases, tetanus. And now, you know, our life expectancy is in the 60s and 70s, and it's really vaccine that's done that, done a lot of it along with clean water.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of minutes. This is a chance to sum up comments you'd like to make, Ginger and Brian.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting us on your program, and I just want to say that now that our listeners know more about the transmission of hepatitis and the risk factors to get themselves tested if they think they're at risk or vaccinated.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that for those people who are born in areas where hepatitis B is very, very endemic that I mentioned, that it would be a good idea for you to go and talk to your provider about getting tested or go to one of the state sites and be tested for hepatitis B. And also urge you that if you're due for your vaccine shots or your children are, to please get those hepatitis A and B vaccine shots. Mm-hmm. Or you're traveling to an endemic area before you go.
Got just about a minute. Any myth that comes to mind that anybody needs to try to discuss before we move on?
No, but I just wanted to add to the vaccination that, you know, in the 20 years I've been a maternal child health nurse and immunization nurse, and I work alongside our immunization program, and the thousands and thousands of immunizations I've given and know that have been given, there are very few reports of adverse events. You know, nothing is 100%, but in all the years in immunizations I've been around, I have to say that there have been very few bad outcomes.
And we need to be straightforward and reasonable. There is nothing without risk. And I
That's
try to
right.
explain to many of my families that there is risk to vaccines, but it's probably a heck of a lot less than the fact that you drove in here in a car and are going to leave here in a car this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks very much. I very much appreciate Brian McMahon and Ginger Provo for the time they've spent with us today in educating us on hepatitis.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, Dad.
Next week, we're going to be back, and we're going to be talking about insomnia, those of you who have trouble getting to sleep or staying to sleep, and other sleep disorders with Dr. David Klayman. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, June 1st at 2 p.m. We repeat the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.